This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West here on RN. Is the blood of a political dissident the price of doing business in Saudi Arabia? And has Joe Biden failed his first test on human rights?
But the shocking thing is that after all of his promises, Joe Biden did nothing to honor Khashoggi's memory or to punish the Crown Prince. And because Saudi Arabia has been a strategic partner of the United States, Joe Biden, I guess, in the end decided that he had to do business with him.
That's ahead on the show. And as Pope Francis prepares to leave for Iraq, you'll hear a bishop who fled the Islamic State group for refuge here in Australia. Now, before we get started, during our segment on RN Breakfast, you probably heard a preview of an interview about how China is using Buddhism as part of an aggressive foreign policy. It is an absolutely fascinating discussion with Dr. Greg Raymond, but he deserves a bit more time than we've got today. So tune in next week for that story. US security officials have released their report into the murder of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. To no one's surprise, it found the murder was almost certainly ordered by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The Saudi government denies the prince's involvement. But the intelligence report is arguably a bigger test for President Joe Biden and his human rights credentials. Because before winning the presidency, he promised a foreign policy that was more ethical than Donald Trump's. So what's happened? Robin Wright is a top foreign affairs journalist and a contributing writer at The New Yorker, where she writes about the Khashoggi affair. And she reminded me of what Joe Biden had said about the Saudis.
As a candidate, Joe Biden had talked about Saudi Arabia as a pariah state. He said the country had no redeeming social value. And he was very explicit in condemning specifically the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as having a key role and responsibility in the murder and eventual dismemberment of Jamal Khashoggi.
So he drew a very sharp distinction between his position, should he become president, and that of the Trump administration. Because, Robin, just remind us, how had the Trump administration treated Saudi Arabia and the Crown Prince?
Well, Saudi Arabia had been the first stop by President Donald Trump when he began touring the world. That's how important it was, going to Riyadh, being feted by the royal family, launching this counterterrorism center. And the Crown Prince had been central in developing that relationship, both with the president and his key advisor, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. And the two young men, both young fathers, had become very good friends. They talked by WhatsApp. They talked late into the night when Jared Kushner went to the kingdom. They had a personal and a professional relationship. And so the Crown Prince was considered one of the Trump White House's most important allies.
So for 2 years, as I said, Robin, at least until now, we had a sharp distinction between the former president, his administration, and Joe Biden. What happened?
During the Trump administration, the CIA did an analysis of what it believed happened to the Saudi journalist on that fateful visit to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. And it came to the conclusion that the Crown Prince had approved Khashoggi's murder. But what, of course, Trump prevented from happening was the release of that report. And that fell to Joe Biden after he took office. He had promised during the election he would release the report as is required by American law. And he did that this last week. And it confirmed what everyone had always known, what the UN had said in its own investigation, that the Crown Prince not only approved of the murder, but that the team, the hit squad, 15 men, were part of his broader rapid intervention force known as the Tiger Squad. And that there was no way that the Crown Prince would ever not have known about this and had to have played a role. What's, I think, shocking about the aftermath of the report's release is that Joe Biden did absolutely nothing to punish the Crown Prince. The United States introduced sanctions of a handful of Saudi operatives and introduced something called the Khashoggi rule, which will henceforth prevent American visas from being granted to people suspected of abusing, repressing, or murdering dissidents and journalists. But the shocking thing is that after all of his promises, Joe Biden did nothing to honor Khashoggi's memory or to punish the Crown Prince.
Yeah, because as you say, the CIA report basically fingered the Crown Prince as being at the top of this operation, approving the murder of Khashoggi. What's the rationale, Robin, for basically letting the Crown Prince get off scot-free?
Well, this is where I think the administration is coming up against a lot of criticism, because the calculation was that the Crown Prince, who is in his mid-30s, will rule the kingdom for potentially 30, 40, or even 50 years, that he has consolidated, since becoming the Crown Prince in 2017, all five channels to power in the military, in the economy, in internal security, among the clerics, and that the idea that there will be someone else in the royal family who could topple him is unlikely. And because Saudi Arabia has been a strategic partner of the United States, that Joe Biden, I guess, in the end decided that he had to do business with him. But this has created an enormous backlash in Washington.
What hold does the Saudi regime appear to have over successive American administrations, Democrat and Republican?
The relationship really came out of the first meeting between Franklin Roosevelt, just a few weeks before he died, and Ibn Saud, the founder of modern Saudi Arabia, in 1945. They met on a ship in secret in the Suez Canal. And Franklin Roosevelt understood that oil was going to be important, increasingly important, for post-war industry and to fuel American cars. That relationship deepened, of course, after 1973 and the quadrupling of oil prices. And as Iran, during its revolution, no longer was a pillar of U.S. foreign policy in the region. So Saudi Arabia took on more and more importance. What's striking about today is that the Khashoggi report came out just at a time the U.S. is increasingly energy independent.
Yeah. I mean, very telling.
Now, it doesn't need the kingdom very much anymore. Now, it argues that because of tensions between the United States and Iran, that it needs allies close by. But the fact is, Saudi Arabia needs the United States far more than the United States needs Saudi Arabia.
I mean, what is it also about the Crown Prince, for example, Mohammed bin Salman? Because you give this roll call of all of these people, some of whom would be progressive heroes in inverted commas, Oprah Winfrey, Bill Gates, Michael Bloomberg, Michael Douglas, Bill Clinton, they've all fated this Crown Prince. What is it that he seems to have over certain parts of the American elite?
When he came to power, he had promised that they would open up Saudi Arabia, that he'd diversify the economy, that he'd provide greater rights for women, that he'd allow more kind of a social life for people outside the home. So he is still very popular in Saudi Arabia. The problem is he has not followed through on many of his promises. And even when he does, he sometimes is hypocritical. For example, on women's rights, there was a wonderful young activist. All she wanted to do was push for women to have the right to drive. I mean, shock, horror, drama, probe, just to drive. And the Crown Prince promised that women would get that right, but he nevertheless arrested her and several other women activists. So there's a great hypocrisy. The Crown Prince clearly is willing to act against anyone who criticizes him or challenges him, even on the most basic human rights issues.
Robin, you know this area of the world intimately. You've written authoritatively about it. You've been in Iran. That was the reason we spoke to you the last time about the 40th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution. I'm not in any way suggesting that the Iranian regime is in any way benign. But I wonder, if you were an American decision maker and you had to choose these days between Riyadh, that is Saudi Arabia, or Tehran as an ally or as someone to even just keep on side in a general way, is it possible to make that choice?
It's a tough choice for an American government, given the history after the revolution of the seizure of the U.S. embassy and American hostages that really reshaped how America viewed itself. It was a moment, especially coming shortly after the Vietnam War, that America felt very vulnerable and not like the superpower that it claimed to be. I have asked that very question of many foreign policymakers, and they will tell you off the record that the more natural ally is probably Iran because of its people, its rich history, and given the fact that women vote and they're members of parliament and they can drive, never any question about that. They've won Nobel Peace Prizes and awards at film festivals in Cannes. And Saudi Arabia is one of the most repressive regimes in the world. It's a tough choice, and so it's, you know, not an obvious choice. But in terms of the size of the population, the fact that Iran has the 14th largest military in the world, and that strategically it faces not just the Middle East, but South Asia, the volatile Afghanistan, Pakistan, and some of the former Soviet republics, that it is strategically incredibly important. But again, it's in some ways the devil's choice.
Yeah, and one that you and I fortunately don't have to make a decision about. Always good to talk to you. Robin Wright, she's a leading American commentator on the Middle East, a writer for The New Yorker. Robin's written many books. The most recent, I think, Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. Robin, great to talk to you again.
Thank you. And just as a reminder, Jamal Khashoggi had been a friend of mine for 30 years, so this had a deeply personal as well as professional impact on me.
And this is the Religion and Ethics Report. Next week in Sydney, a group of faith and community leaders will launch a major document called the Sydney Statement, building bridges between believers from different religions. It's an initiative of the Parliament of the World's Religions. It's also endorsed by the New South Wales Government, the Columbans and Western Sydney University. And we'll bring you more on this significant statement in a future program, but you can find it at thesydneystatement.org. That's thesydneystatement.org.au. Pope Francis lifts off from Rome on Friday to begin his historic visit to Iraq. He's going to continue his dialogue with Islamic leaders and to support the besieged Christians in the country. The ancient land is a cradle of Christianity, and the Chaldeans were among the world's first Christians. They're part of the worldwide Catholic Church, but they have their own patriarch. Until he was forced to flee Iraq in 2014, Archbishop Amel Nona was the Chaldean bishop of Mosul. He'd lived under persistent threat and ultimately found refuge in Australia. He now heads the Chaldean Catholic Diocese of Australia and New Zealand. Archbishop Nona told me his story.
It was in 2014 when ISIS came to the city of Mosul. And me and all the parishioners of all communities from Mosul and around Mosul, we left the city and the area and went to the north of Iraq, to Kurdistan of Iraq. And ISIS had controlled all the city. We left the diocese and no Christians still there till now. And that's very, very sad, because our presence in the city of Mosul and the area went back to the end of the first century.
You literally had to leave behind the church, all the houses, all the beautiful things inside the church, the crosses, all the decorations?
Everything. We left everything. For example, personally, I left everything just with my clothes, even what belonged to me personally. But most important, we left our churches, our very ancient churches, and a lot of things from the churches, and they destroyed everything.
Now, you had been a leading figure in Iraq, in the religious landscape of Iraq. How much threat had you been placed under personally with the rise of Islamic State group?
You know, I was in Mosul from 2010 to 2014 as Archbishop of the Diocese of Mosul. Of course, there were a lot of threats for me, but more for our people there. It was not easy to live in that situation. And unfortunately, when I went to Mosul in 2010, a lot of people, they already left the city. They remained there, were a small community of Christians, and they were very afraid because there was always a threat in their life, of their properties, so for everything.
Even though you now live in Australia and you're the bishop for Australia and New Zealand, I get the impression, Archbishop, that the soil and the sands of Mesopotamia are deep in your heart and deep in your soul. That is your country. Would you like to go back and live there?
As bishop, I go where the church sends me because I am a missionary in the church. So if the church wants me to serve here, I will serve my community here. If tomorrow, after tomorrow, they send me again back to Iraq, I will. But as you know, when someone born and live and grow in a land, of course, that land will take a good place in his heart and in his life also.
Would you like other Christians who fled Iraq to return?
I can't decide instead of them, but I can say something. For us as Christians, our land where we can live and practice our faith and live our faith freely. So the land for us where we can live as Christians. So today we are in Australia, so Australia is our land.
Yes, I just wonder though, if all of the Christians continue to leave Iraq because of the threats that Pope Francis is now trying to resolve, but if they all leave, what happens to one of the birthplaces of Christianity?
It is very sad when we think about that, really, because of our presence as Christians. Go back to the end of the first century, but we were there also before that. We are the indigenous people of Iraq as Chaldeans. So it's very sad today to think that one day there will be no more Christians there. But we hope we can arrive to that day because they are still there. Of course, they are a minority there, but they still Christians in that land. And we hope that the visit of our Holy Father will support them more to stay in that land.
You obviously talk a lot to the members of your church, the Chaldean Church here in Australia. They, I suspect, still have family in Iraq. What do they tell you about their families in Iraq?
All of us, we have families in Iraq. They're still there. The situation there, it's not good. Currently, there's a COVID-19 virus, and the political system is very bad in Iraq now. The corruption in the regime is very bad. It's not easy to live in the land that you feel that you have all the duties but not all the rights. It's not easy to live there. I know that a lot of our people who they live there, they feel very bad for that, but we pray that one day the situation will change.
Just finally, have you had the chance to talk to Pope Francis about the situation in Iraq?
Yes, of course. 2 years ago, I was with the Australian bishops in a visit to Holy Father, and I talked with him a bit about that. But before that also, when I was Archbishop in Mosul, I met him, and I talked about the situation also.
And what did he say was the thing that most upset him?
The thing that upset him was that the people, they can't live freely. And he said that there's no reason to make other people not happy in their life.
Archbishop Amel Nona, who fled ISIS in Iraq and now leads the Chaldean Catholic Church in Australia and New Zealand. Well, for more on the Pope's visit to Iraq, let's check in with Joshua McElwee, Rome correspondent for the independent newspaper, the National Catholic Reporter. He'll be travelling to Iraq with Pope Francis. Josh, we've got COVID, we've got this continuing terror threat in Iraq. Why is the Pope still going?
I think there's basically two main objectives. One is to encourage the small Christian community in Iraq, which has been so devastated by ISIS and by the U.S. invasion of the country in 2003. And the second objective is to pursue kind of this high-level Muslim-Christian dialogue with the Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani. And so I think we're seeing a Pope insistent on continuing his mission, on kind of retaking up the ministry as it was before the COVID pandemic, bringing into light some of the concerns for Iraq, for kind of those in need still around the world who have may have been a bit forgotten during the COVID pandemic, and wanting basically to continue on.
You mentioned in passing there, Josh, the 2003 US invasion of Iraq. I'm not in any sense suggesting there's a sort of I told you so here, but there is a certain, I guess, poignant element to this, because I think the Vatican, going back to John Paul II and Benedict, warned strongly against the invasion of Iraq and all the chaos that it would cause. So there is something kind of poignant here.
Yeah, Pope John Paul II at the time in 2003 was very insistent that he thought the invasion was a bad idea. He sent the Vatican ambassador to the U.S. at the time to go meet with President George W. Bush to try and convince him that, you know, they should stop the invasion. Obviously, that didn't work. And what we have seen since is a real diminishment of the Christian community. The Christian community in Iraq is very varied. It comes from different traditions, different rites, but they all kind of trace their beginnings to the time of the apostles, to the very earliest decades of the church. And the numbers are a bit unsure, but it looks like they've lost about half of their numbers since the invasion and since the rise of ISIS and then the destruction of their traditional hometowns in the north of Iraq, in Mosul and Karakesh, around that area. Quite poignantly, Francis is going to go to those areas on the third day of his trip on March 7th, and he will visit them. He will visit a cathedral in Mosul that was essentially pillaged and destroyed and has been rebuilt, just so he can see it as it was. And we're expecting he should give some beautiful message about being a Christian in such a difficult time. And Francis is a pope who is comfortable being uncomfortable and comfortable not knowing what to say or what he can do other than just be there and be with the people. And I think that's a bit of what he wants to do. He wants to go, he wants to be with his Christian brothers and sisters and just feel with them what they're feeling.
He is going also to offer a prayer for the victims of the Islamic State group. I'm assuming, though, given his interfaith outreach over the years, it won't just be a prayer for Christian victims of Islamic State.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we're going to see a very interreligious focus. The Pope in the past few years has been very active, especially with Muslim-Christian dialogue. So I think this will be his ninth visit to a Muslim-majority nation. In recent years, he was the first pope to go to Egypt. He went to Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates, the first pope to go there, the first pope to go to the Arabian Peninsula, where he met with the Imam of Al-Hazar, the main Islamic learning center in Egypt, and they signed a document on human fraternity, which has been kind of hailed as a landmark document between Muslim and Christian leaders. Now we will see the pope meet with the Shiite Muslim cleric Al-Sistani. And obviously, Francis is trying to say we religious leaders can stand together on issues of dialogue, on issues of human dignity, human fraternity, and in opposing any sort of religious violence.
There have been continued suicide bombings in Baghdad. I mean, there were some just in the past month or two. Has this not given pause at all to the Vatican to rethink this?
There is certainly some concern among Vatican officials about the Pope's safety. I think also the Pope is quite insistent that he wants to go. I think we're going to see a very tight security bubble around the Pope and around those traveling with him during the visit. For people who have watched the Pope visit abroad before, I don't think we'll be seeing the large crowd lining the streets. I think it will be kind of antiseptic. It won't be the kind of atmosphere we expect from Francis, where he's kind of wading into the crowds. And I think also there's some dynamic of Iraq right now is under a pretty strict coronavirus lockdown because of a rise in cases. And a couple of Vatican officials I spoke to, you know, kind of quietly said, you know, that might actually help the security issue because there's going to be less movement about the country. People are going to be expected to be more in their homes, and that could make the security bubble around the Pope even tighter.
Yeah, I was going to ask how the COVID-19 crisis might crimp this visit, especially to a place like the Middle East, which is legendary. Anyone who's travelled there will tell you it is legendary for its hospitality. You know, how's this going to put limits on the visit?
I think it may emerge as a major issue. I had done some reporting earlier in December when the visit was first announced about health experts kind of wondering why the Pope was choosing to do this so soon, just as the vaccines were kind of coming online, just as the global health system was getting prepared, hopefully, to kind of reduce the risk. From the Pope's point of view, I think he thinks because he and everyone traveling with him are going to be vaccinated, the risk to them is quite low. The Vatican has informed us that we'll be wearing the filtered N95 masks the whole time while we travel. I spoke to the Archbishop in Erbil, who said for all the public events, they are basically taking names in advance, assigning seats, and taking people's phone numbers. So if a case did emerge, they would be able to contact trace later. I think we're in the realm of kind of acknowledged risk and everyone hoping that the measures they've put in place, should there be some case during the visit afterwards, it could be, you know, they would be able to respond quickly and try to limit risk.
I mean, you, as one of the people traveling with the Pope, have been compelled to have the COVID-19 vaccine, I believe.
Yeah, all of the journalists traveling with the Pope, we were mandated to have the vaccine before we could travel. And the Vatican offered those vaccines to those of us in Rome, able to kind of come to the Vatican and receive both doses.
I noticed that the Pope said, and this is very sort of apropos, all of this concern about terrorism, look, I'm not afraid of risking my life for my ministry. The thing is, I doubt the Iraqis would want any risk to the Pope.
Yeah, I think obviously the political authorities in Iraq, part of the visit is they want to show that they are able to welcome visitors such as the Pope, that I think the country has stabilized a little bit, that it's safer than it was a few years ago, especially under when ISIS controlled parts of the country. And I think they want to show that they're able to host these kinds of visits and they're able to be, you know, a more normal political country where people can come and travel.
Just finally, Josh, on a completely unrelated matter, the retired Pope Benedict XVI gave an interview recently and he had some rather interesting advice for some of his most ardent followers. What was it?
Well, we're marking February 28th, the 8th anniversary of Pope Benedict's resignation, the first in 600 years. And he gave an interview basically telling people there are not two popes. There is one pope. His name is Francis. And Benedict said that some of his supporters had been a bit fanatical and hadn't kind of accepted his resignation, but that he felt very at peace with it, that he thought it was the right thing to do for the church. And he told them there's only one pope.
Joshua McElwee, he's the Rome correspondent for the independent newspaper, the National Catholic Reporter. He'll be travelling later this week with Pope Francis on that historic visit to Iraq. Thanks for joining us as always, Josh.
Yeah, great to be with you.
And that is the program for this week. Now, remember, next week we're looking at China and the way that it is using Buddhism as a form of foreign policy. A fascinating interview with Greg Raymond. We're at the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your favourite podcasts. Thanks to Mudita Dias and Jerome Commissari. I'm Andrew West. The Religion and Ethics Report is back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.